It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The Bristol Renaissance Fair is in full swing, and Renaissance Fairs aren't for everybody. Haters are going to say, heck no.
And the lovers will say, huzzah!
Patrick Rothfuss wins this round, by the way. We're calling this regular segment Geek Out instead of Nerd Up after a little bit of discussion about that last time around. And today we're looking at the appeal of Renaissance fairs. Ethan Gilsdorf joins us now. He's a journalist and the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. Ethan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica and Rob. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, so Renaissance fairs, are you a believer? Are you a fan?
Yes, I must believe. Absolutely. I mean, what's wonderful about the Renaissance fairs, like so many opportunities for entertainment today, is, you know, they appeal to their people. And, you know, as you said in your introduction, if you're not into it, you know, then you don't go. It's a wonderful, wonderful celebration of a particular period of time in history.
So for people who aren't into them, who haven't been, what exactly goes down at your average Renaissance fair?
Sure. Well, basically, you know, some of them are permanent. Most of them are temporary, you know, that happen during the warmer months of the summertime, sometimes open only during the weekends, and other times, you know, day after day over the course of the summer. And essentially, it's imagining a time in history, the late Elizabethan period, the sort of high Middle Ages, a kind of recreation of a village or a medieval village. So you might think of it as sort of a craft fair, sort of a historical reenactment, but also a kind of performance. And, you know, in some regards, it's more of an amusement park than it is, you know, an actual, you know, historically accurate thing. It's really for entertainment purposes. And there's opportunities to shop and look at performers and, you know, eat some period food and see some jousting and musicians, jugglers, all that stuff.
So, Ethan, when you go, do you, you know, get dressed up in your best Renaissance garb and put on your best Elizabethan accent and all of that?
Well, m'lady, I don't have my own garb. I have a very humble tunic that I actually sewed myself when I was researching my book, Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. I mean, this is one of the misconceptions, and maybe it gets to your earlier sort of, nod to the naysayers, is that, you know, you can go and dress in your own period costume if you want to, but it's not required. I mean, this isn't a role-playing game where you're going to be singled out, you know, if you're not sort of, you know, dressed appropriately. A lot of people do go in costume. All the people who will work at the Renaissance Fair are going to be in costume, and some of them will interact with you in period accent and, you know, maybe playing a specific character. But your role is just to come. It's like going to Disneyland. You can dress up in a funny costume if you want to, or you can play it straight.
I want to invite people to head over to our Central Time Facebook page. If you have a plug for a favorite Renaissance fair in Wisconsin or beyond, or if you are a participant, you are part of the activities, go to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us about it and tell us why you do it. Ethan, you wrote a book about the fantasy world people can kind of escape into. Is that part of the Renaissance Fair, the idea of escaping for our daily life and getting into something different?
I think so. I mean, I've thought a lot about this, particularly lately, and certainly is an issue that I got into in my book, this idea of, you know, were there other times in history when, you know, somewhere along the way we lost something that we once had? And of course, you know, the Renaissance Fair is, you know, not entirely historically accurate. And to keep in mind, it's not generally full of elves and wizards and sort of magical things. It's meant to really be, you know, celebrating a real historical period. But, you know, were there things that they did back in those days that we could still benefit from today? You know, escaping into a world where there aren't cell phones and there aren't having to think about looking for parking. Well, you do have to look for parking, I guess, when you enter the facility, you know, the ground. But once you've left your car and you make your way into the gates of the Renaissance Fair, I mean, you know, it's very possible to just sort of just let your mind wander and wonder a little bit about a different way of life. Maybe it was simpler then. It's a romantic notion for sure, but I think it's a fun way to imagine you know, what would have my life been like had I lived during that time period?
One thing is, you're probably out of luck if you're allergic to hay. It seems like every Renaissance fair I've been to is covered in hay.
And plenty of horses as well.
And plenty of horses and all that goes with them, yes. So one thing I'm wondering about is, you know, Renaissance fairs, you know, sometimes they get associated with geekdom, geekery. I wonder if they'd be more popular now, given how popular the TV show and books Game of Thrones are, which is sort of a medieval-type world. It seems like it could exist in a Renaissance fair, only with more, you know, beheadings and blood and that kind of thing. Do you think that Renaissance fairs are maybe going to broaden their appeal?
I think they are, and actually I was doing a little research on your local fair, which I've never been to. I know the one here in Boston is one in the New England area that's a pretty large one, and yours in Bristol is a big one as well. But I noticed that they have some special weekends, one sort of for pirates called Swashbuckler Weekend, and there's another weekend for steampunkers, which is another sort of subculture. So it's clear that, you know, the Renaissance fair industry is doing its best to capitalize on some of the cool other subcultures that are becoming more popular. I don't know they're going to have a superhero Renaissance fair anytime soon, but, you know, Comic-Con in San Diego just ended last weekend, and, you know, that convention, among many examples, Game of Thrones is another example, just proves the extent to which this stuff is popular. And while I think if you showed up in your Captain America or Wonder Woman costume, you would probably look at funny at the Renaissance fair, it would be definitely considered out of period. People might look at you askance. You know, I think the general idea here is that in all ways, in all ways of measuring this, you know, geekdom is ascending in many ways, and finds its expression in so many kinds of experiences like Ren fairs.
Why do you reckon these things get fixated on the medieval Renaissance era? Why isn't there an ancient Roman one or a Manchu Dynasty China fair or something like that?
Yeah.
What is it about medieval Europe that grabs us?
You know, that's a really good question. There are certainly events and role-playing games, even ones you can dress up in costume, where you can specifically focus on these more obscure periods of history or, you know, incorporate fantastical elements into these. But you're right. There is something about that medieval period, or the late, you know, sort of Elizabethan period that captures our fancy. I think there's something in America that, in the same way that we are fascinated by the new royal baby over there in England, that feels quite entranced by this idea of lords and ladies, and you know, a time when perhaps, you know, you could fulfill your destiny and, you know, on the battlefield and sort of, you know your place in relation to everyone else in you know, in your village. There was a certain amount of connectivity, certain amount of direct connection to people, amongst people, that I think we are longing for. You know, we spend a lot of our time sitting in front of our computer screens doing things virtually, and I think there's a real yearning to be outdoors and interact and pick up a sword or a battle axe and, you know, show someone the business end of your weapon, as it were.
Well, Sir Ethan Gilsdorf, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me once again. It was great to be back on your program.
It's great to have you here. Ethan Gilsdorf is a journalist and the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. He sewed his own tunic by hand.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk about economic mobility. It may have been hard for your average medieval peasant to work his or her way up to king or queen, but the American idea is that you could rise from rags to riches. Well, a new study a lot of people are talking about this week says your opportunity to do that may depend on where you were born. That's coming up. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As we recover from an economic downturn, there's lots of questions about opportunities for people to climb up that economic ladder.
New research shows that some areas of the United States have significantly lower rates of economic mobility than other parts of the country.
And that means if you're born poor in a certain area, it might be harder for you to break out of poverty than if you were born somewhere else.
As we talk about this, we want to hear from you. Have you moved up the economic ladder? Do you think your community has equal opportunities for all of its members? Why or why not? What do you think needs to change to make people have similar opportunities? That's 800-642-1234 if you want to join the show. 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And here to break down this new research is Nathaniel Hendren, assistant professor of economics at Harvard and co-author of this new study on economic mobility in the United States. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nathan, is the land of, the United States has this opportunity of being this land of opportunity. Anybody here should be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and make it. Is that still true, do you think, given the results of this study?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think, you know, as you say, we like to think of the United States as a land of opportunity. I think the way we've been interpreting our results is that that's not really a simple question to ask, because as you look across the United States, there's tremendous differences in the extent to which people can rise out of poverty. And so it doesn't seem like there's really a straight answer to the question of whether or not we're the land of opportunity. Some lands are and some lands aren't.
Well, we are coming out of an economic downturn. We hope we're coming out of it. But it's causing a lot of people, you know, to take a look at exactly where we stand. And that used to mean maybe kind of looking at a snapshot of the moment. But now we're sort of taking a long view, which is what your study has done, about what happens over the course of years, whether people are, in fact, able to rise up. And I guess the question is, you know, do we still have a right to be optimistic about that?
Yeah, so I would definitely say that we have a right to be optimistic. And as you say, what we were taking a look at in our study is the extent to which people, kids' outcomes are determined by their parental income. And, I think that there's definitely some rosy pictures coming out of the study. So, and also some more negative pictures. So just by looking across the different areas. So for example, just to give you some kinds of statistics, you can compare places like Madison and Milwaukee there in Wisconsin, somebody who's born to a family earning less than $25,000 a year has about a 10% chance of earning more than $100,000 when they grow up if they were born in Madison. But that same chance is only 6%, about half as much if they were born in Milwaukee. And so what we're trying to highlight is just this tremendous kind of variation. Madison, Milwaukee, even close together, if you look across the United States, you can see even more variation. And what we're trying to do is call attention to this and start a discussion about what might be these factors that are driving these differences in mobility.
And before we go any further, let's see if we can get a definition of economic mobility out there on the table. How would you describe that?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of different ways you can measure it. So the measure I just gave you was, so imagine somebody who's born to a poor family or a family in poverty. What's the chance that their child kind of reaches into kind of the upper tiers of the income ladder? That's sort of one notion of economic opportunity. You can also think of people born to parents maybe earning a little bit more, maybe $30,000 or a little bit more. What's on average the chance that what's the average earning of those types of children, along these different dimensions, what we actually found was that to the extent to which you're focused on kind of measures of how well kids that are born into kind of lower income families are doing, it doesn't really matter a whole lot how you're measuring it, as long as you're focusing on sort of the outcomes of kids born to these poor families. You see the same kind of spatial pattern. So I think that there's a lot of different ways you can measure it, but the general spatial patterns are pretty similar.
Now, we talked a little bit about Madison, Milwaukee. Can you give us the big view of the country as a whole? Where are the best places to live for economic mobility, and what are some of the worst?
Great question. So some of the broad swath of differences, in general, you see kind of the Mountain West, the Midwest, starting at kind of Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, and moving west out into California, kind of have the highest rates of upward mobility. So kids born to poor backgrounds tend to do the best. In contrast, areas of the Rust Belt, or in the South especially, tend to have the lowest rates of upward mobility. So those same statistics I was just giving you for Madison, Milwaukee, if you were born in Atlanta or Charlotte, for example, the chance of and your parents earned less than $25,000 a year, the chance of you earning more than $100,000 a year is less than 4%. And so it's a very dramatic difference to the same number for Madison, which was about 10%.
Now, if you look at a city like Milwaukee, where your chances for economic mobility are less good than if you live in, say, Madison, you look at that city and it has a reputation for being one of the most segregated cities, certainly in Wisconsin, but I think nationally that is true as well. How does race play into this?
Yeah, so two things to mention there. So the first thing, the pattern with segregation, both income segregation and racial segregation, is definitely something that you see in the data. So areas that have where the poorer population is more geographically segregated from the middle class, we find that that's correlated with lower rates of upward mobility. Similarly, areas where there's more racial segregation, geographic racial segregation within an area, we find that's negatively related to upward mobility. Now, the other question that you can think about is the sort of fraction of people that are of Africa, people that are African Americans in an area, and there you do find a negative relationship between the average mobility of the local population and the fraction of African Americans in an area. However, it doesn't seem to be driven by just racial differences in outcomes. What it really seems to the easiest way to think about this is that white people in the South have lower rates of upward mobility than white people in, say, Salt Lake City.
So I guess what you're saying is that race doesn't seem to be quite the large factor you thought it was?
Well, I think that, I wouldn't say we went into it thinking that race was going to be a huge
factor. Or I guess that I should say that we might have expected. Yeah, not you.
I think that the way to think about it is that there seem to be characteristics of places. Some of which are more mobile and some of which are less mobile. And the broad set of characteristics that we focused on, we started with things like economic policies. So we imagined that differences in economic policies and programs for the poor would drive some of the differences that we see across areas. Now, what we ended up finding is that some of the strongest correlations were things like economic segregation and the size of the middle class, along with measures of school quality, K-12 education. And we also found strong correlations with measures of social cohesiveness and social capital, so the strength of kind of social ties in an area. And finally, one of the strongest correlations that we found was measures of family structure. So areas that have more two-parent households tended to have greater rates of upward mobility.
And who's responsible for creating the climate in that city? You know, is it the city governance? Is it the state? Is it federal policy? I mean, how does that sort of thing get decided?
So that's a great question. I think that that's really speaking to kind of how old are these differences across places. Our measures are really a snapshot of people that grew up in the 1980s and 90s. Actually, people like myself, actually. And I think that there's a question there that's embedded in your question, which is this something that is sort of more rooted in these different areas, or is this something that's changing dramatically over time? Our sense is that it's not changing incredibly quickly, because we can see some of that, some evidence of that in our data, but we don't know how far back this actually goes. There's a lot of different hypotheses that would be out there, and I think a lot of those will hopefully be tested in the future.
So I guess the ideal is that a city like Atlanta would take a look at Seattle and say, hey, what is Seattle doing that we can emulate so that we have more economic upward mobility here?
That is exactly what we would hope happens, and that's you put it almost perfectly right. I mean, that was the primary goal of really trying to use this differences across areas to try to understand what is it about different places that are improving outcomes for poor kids.
And what has been the reaction so far? This has been an article, you know, the New York Times ran a piece about it. This has been much talked about. What's the reaction been?
Yeah, I mean, we've been very surprised. We had a sense that we found it interesting, and that's why we did the study and we put this together. But I guess stepping back, I think it is, you know, everybody has a sense that it kind of matters where they grew up. And I think this is a study where, in some sense, it's stating the obvious fact that it kind of matters where you grew up. But on another level, it's all, I think, also stating how important it really is where you live. And I think that's something that, we're hoping to just put data to the kinds of intuitions that I think people have had all along.
So if you're living in a city like Atlanta, I hate to pick on Atlanta here, but you want to raise your kids.
They've been picked on a lot, yeah.
You want to raise your kids and you want them to have good opportunities. Would you do well to pull up camp and move somewhere else, Salt Lake City, Seattle, one of these other upwardly mobile cities?
So that's a great question. So Raj Chetty, a co-author on the study with me here, and I are working on precisely that question at the moment. And the evidence we have now is pretty preliminary, but it is safe to say that we think you can at least get some of that difference by picking up and moving. But I think that I'd be hard-pressed to say exactly how much.
Well, because city, I mean, it takes a long time to affect change in a city. I mean, it could take, you know, the length of your child's childhood till they hit 18 or something like that. So, you know, it just makes you wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, just goes back to what you were saying before about the question of, you know, what is it between these two, between Salt Lake City and Atlanta, or between Milwaukee and Madison, or, you know, if you even you know, you can compare areas out in San Francisco. All these places have very different mobility experiences, and I think the question is, what is it about these places that are really really driving this difference? And as you say, what can places do to really attack the differences and try to improve upward mobility? I mean, this goes back to some of the correlates that I was talking about earlier. So things like school quality. I mean, we know from a large body of economic research that the quality of schools matters a heck of a lot for kids' outcomes, and we do find a positive relationship between the quality of local school systems and rates of upward mobility. And so I think that on some level, the study is verifying things that we have kind of known for a while, but I think it's also suggesting that we don't know all of the factors that are really driving these differences, and kind of hopefully pushes a research towards really understanding all of the reasons for these differences.
Well, we're talking right now to Nathan Hendren. He's assistant professor of economics at Harvard, about a new study he co-authored on economic mobility in the United States.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you moved around the country? What do you think makes the difference in economic mobility and opportunity in different places? Did you move to seize an opportunity somewhere else? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're going to continue our conversation now about new research that shows some areas of the United States have significantly lower rates of economic mobility than other areas. And what that essentially means is that if you're born poor in a certain area, it's going to be a lot harder for you to break out of poverty than if you're born in a different area with better economic mobility.
And we want to hear from you this hour at 800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. Does this make sense to you? Have you been in areas where you think there's no way to get out of poverty here? And are there areas that make you feel more optimistic? Talk@WPR.org is the email.
And we're talking with Nathaniel Hendren. He's an assistant professor of economics at Harvard and co-author of this new study we're talking about on economic mobility in the United States. And we go to our first caller. We've got Eric on the line from Sun Prairie. Hi, Eric. Eric, are you with us?
Yeah, how are you guys doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Oh, can't complain too much. So I had two comments. Milwaukee and Minneapolis, fairly similar in size, geography, heritage, and all that. Why is there so much less opportunity in Milwaukee than there is in Minneapolis? And then my second comment question was, again, to pick on Atlanta, which seems to be the theme so far. If everybody with the means to get out of there to give their children a better opportunity does so, doesn't that pretty much just doom Atlanta to, or whatever city everybody emigrates from, doesn't that just pretty much reconcile it to downward mobility?
Right. A couple of great questions. Great. Thank you for those, Eric. And what do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, so I'll start with the first question. So Milwaukee versus Minneapolis. I mean, I think it's so just to refer to what the caller was talking about. You know, we were talking earlier about what's the chance if you're born to a family earning less than $25,000 a year that your kid is going to earn, say, $100,000 or more. And in Milwaukee, that's 6%, and in Minneapolis, that's about 9%, so about 50% higher in Minneapolis. Now, why? That's the really important question here, and I think what we can tell you is that there's various correlates that explain a lot of the variation across areas in these mobility rates. And so one thing that does separate out Milwaukee from other cities is its higher rates of racial and economic segregation. Now, that's not to say that that's particularly the cause for one particular city, but when you look across areas across the United States, that does seem to be an important factor for determining the differences in rates of economic mobility. Regarding the second question, I guess I have a different interpretation of Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta is not necessarily a sort of city that's sort of on the decline from most economic perspectives. And so I think that you know, it's not so much of just a kind of a general spiral. What I would say is that these that an area like Atlanta, what we're imagining, or what the just come back to kind of the definition of mobility here, we're imagining, you know, you fix somebody who is born into a poor household and ask them how well do their kids do, and it's right that to say that people that do better are more likely to leave. So for example, I guess an easy way to see this is places that are kind of surrounding cities. If your kids are doing really well, they might go into those cities and get a high-paying job, and that's a very important channel for upward mobility. But it's important to keep in mind that when a child moves, when a child moves to a city, we credit the place that they grew up. So the measures that we're putting out here are really measures of mobility based on where you grow up. And so if there's places where there are high rates of a migration to cities, I hope I'm not wrong in saying this, but I believe places like Iowa have higher rates of migration into places like Chicago for people that are reaching the top tiers of the income distribution, that's definitely a factor that we're crediting to Iowa, not necessarily to Chicago.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your call, Eric. And on to Bruce in Madison. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The professor seems to have divided up his study along racial and financial lines. And the building block of our society traditionally has been the family. And I'd like to know what percentages the professor has studied and how the percentages figure in a single family or dual parent family, as far as how that would be motivational to provide opportunity and growth from a single family or and I'm not talking about dual incomes here. I'm talking about the household itself.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your study find there in making those comparisons?
All right. Thank you so much for that, Bruce. And Nathan, we talked a little bit about that. You talked about communities and families. What do you think?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Bruce. So Bruce's question hits on one of the major correlates that we find in the study. So rates, so places that have higher rates of single-parent households, I think I said this earlier, have much lower mobility. That's actually one of the strongest correlations we're able to see in the data. Now, one interesting caveat to that is that it doesn't seem to be driven by people in single-parent households. So what we mean by that is in areas where there are more single parents, people born into married parents tend to have lower rates of upward mobility. So what really seems to be going on is that the fraction of single parents or people who are single parents in an area seems to be correlated with some property of the place or some kind of property of the culture or some, you know, some characteristic that isn't necessarily about the family structure per se, but seems to be driving the differences in mobility across areas.
That's interesting. So you're saying that it's not so much having a family union with two parents, it's just a different
Well, so it's
factor.
True that the kids born to two-parent households do, on average, better than kids born to single-parent households. That's a well-known fact. What we're saying is that the size of the correlation that we're finding with the rates of upward mobility as compared to the rates of single-parent households is incredibly large and holds almost equally strongly for kids born into to married households. And so what we think is that this is more capturing, when you look across the United States, it's more capturing just some differences in the properties of the place that makes them more or less mobile. It's not the particular rates of being born into a single parent household that's driving the difference.
So what do you think you're going to be looking at next now that you've got this data in?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the way we see this study is identifying these tremendous differences in the rates at which people rise out of poverty. And the next question is obviously to really tease out why. You know, I mentioned some of these correlates that we'd explored earlier, things like school quality and others. And school quality is one case where we actually have some really good evidence that the quality of local schools really does matter for improving kids' outcomes. And I think what we've identified in this study is that there's a lot of other remaining variation across areas. We don't know why that variation is there, and I think what we want to look at is what kinds of policies places like Atlanta or other places that are experiencing low mobility can do to make them look more like Salt Lake City or other places like San Francisco, Boston, that have higher rates of upward mobility.
Now, we've talked a lot about the United States. Do you have a sense of how, as a whole, the U.S. compares to, you know, say Europe in general or Canada?
That's a great question. So it's generally perceived that the United States, at least in the academic community, that the United States has lower rates of mobility than most rich countries in Europe. What we have shown in this study is that some areas like Salt Lake City, the place that I was just mentioning, actually have mobility rates very comparable to a lot of the countries in Western Europe. Now, in contrast, what we've also highlighted is that some of the areas with lower mobility rates are literally off the charts from a global perspective amongst rich countries. There's really no comparison, at least at a country level, to the level of immobility in these regions in the United States.
Has this made you think differently about, you know, our assumptions about what America is and what's possible here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think it's made me step back and think, you know, can we even talk about a single America as being the land of opportunity or not? I think that's not really a very well-posed question, because when you look at the data, there's some areas that are just tremendous at providing equal opportunity, and there's some areas that aren't. And it's pretty hard to imagine, you know, answering a question of, is the United States the land of opportunity? It doesn't make sense to me anymore.
More complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nathaniel Hendren, assistant professor of economics at Harvard, and he was co-author of the study we were just talking about.
Coming up next, we'll learn how exercise can help calm anxiety. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 5, we'll hear how Wisconsin feels about Governor Scott Walker and President Barack Obama, according to a survey released today.
First, though, we're going to talk exercise. You know, there are these obvious benefits that everyone's heard about for exercise. There's weight loss and heart health and lots of other physical things that go along with that. And now there's research that backs up what a lot of people who exercise may have already figured out. It helps with anxiety, too.
Gretchen Reynolds joins us now. She's phys ed columnist for the New York Times Well blog and the author of The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, and Live Longer. Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, in this piece that we're talking about, you wrote about a study of runners and anxiety. What were the researchers looking for?
Well, it's been known, at least anecdotally, for a long time that, as you mentioned, people who are fit, people who exercise, and also animals who are getting a lot of activity tend to be less anxious. They deal with stress better. And it wasn't completely clear why that was so. I mean, it was obvious that exercise is itself a form of stress. And so there was originally some thinking that maybe it sort of inoculated you, made the body better able to handle any other kind of stress. But that clearly didn't answer all of the questions. So scientists started looking at the neuroscience of exercise and of anxiety. And what they found was really pretty fascinating. The first thing they found was that exercise increases pretty dramatically the number of new neurons that you will make in your brain. And that may surprise some people to start with, because some people don't think we make new neurons. But we do, in fact, make new neurons throughout our adult life. If you exercise, you make a lot more of them, 2 or 3 times as many. But what was happening, what the researchers found, was that a lot of these neurons were what they call very excitable neurons. That means they fire really easily with almost any provocation. It's sort of like preschoolers after snack time. They're bouncing off the walls, essentially. And that's really good in terms of improving thinking, memory, that sort of thing. It's not good at all in terms of dealing with stress. If you're in a situation that's not life-threatening, that doesn't require you to run away from a tiger or something, then if you have all of these neurons firing in a stressful situation, it's counterproductive. It just causes anxiety. So what scientists couldn't understand, and this is what's really interesting, is how it was that exercise was helping the mind to create all of these new neurons, but also allowing people and animals who exercise to be very resistant to stress.
Right. So what did they find?
Well, a group of scientists using really sophisticated neurological equipment and techniques discovered that there actually is another kind of neuron that you make a lot of when you exercise that is sort of what I call the nanny neurons. They're neurons that actually quiet activity in the brain. They essentially shush other neurons and say, calm down. They release a chemical that reduces brain activity. And what the researchers found when they studied mice was that if they had the mice run for a period of weeks so that they were very fit, those mice wound up with a lot more, not only of the hyperactive excitable neurons, but also of the nanny neurons. So when the scientists put these mice in a really stressful situation, their excitable neurons would start to go off, and then the nanny neurons would release a chemical that quieted the brain down. And so the end result was that the animals that had been running were much better able to deal with stress and became much less anxious than similar animals who had not run. Their neurons just fired, but no other neurons told them, calm down.
Now, looking at the human runners, they had these excitable neurons and then the nanny neurons reining them in and calming them down. Did they report a subjective feeling? Did they try to measure how the runners reported their anxiety levels, their stress levels?
This particular study was just in mice, and that's because the testing that they do does require some fairly invasive work with the brains themselves, and we're not going to be doing that in people anytime soon. So in this case, we have to actually just extrapolate from what happened in the mouse studies. And they did do studies with these mice looking at the rodent version of anxiety. And the runners were clearly after they'd finished their running program, were just at a baseline level, were much calmer than the other animals. They were much more willing to go explore, to do all the sorts of things that suggest that an animal is very well adjusted, not neurotic. And the animals that had not run were just naturally more nervous. Excuse me. And then when they put the animals in a very stressful situation, they put them in cold water, which mice just don't like. And the runners were much better able afterwards to handle the stress, whereas the animals that had not run, all of their excitable neurons were firing. There were no shushing neurons. They were really nervous mice.
So do we know how long that effect lasts? Does it just happen after exercise, or is this something that would be with you all day long?
It should be with you pretty much permanently, because what this was in this experiment, and it's probably true with people too, is that this was actually what they call a training response, meaning it wasn't acute. It wasn't due to the animals running right before they got in this cold bath. They actually were not allowed to run the day before they got in the cold bath. So that the researchers were looking at, is this a more long-lasting response? And it appears that the runners' brains were actually permanently different than the non-runners' brains. They presumably, for the rest of their lives, would be better able to deal with stress than the animals that did not exercise.
So in the bigger picture, are we building up a lot of research like this that's showing the effects of exercise on our mood, on our anxiety levels?
Oh, absolutely. And that's in both people and animals. There's really good evidence that exercise is extremely helpful in helping people to recover from and avoid depression. And some of that may be because you do make all of these new brain cells in a portion of the brain that's called the hippocampus that is really involved with emotions. And if you exercise, you make a lot more of all kinds of neurons in that portion of the brain. And it seems to be really helpful at improving mood, both, you know, in a relatively small way, helping you to deal with stress, and in a much bigger way, which is fighting off depression.
Gretchen, do we have any idea just how much exercise is needed to get the happy nanny neurons going? Of course, we want to hear not that much, but, you know, maybe we don't know.
The answer actually appears to be, and again, this requires extrapolating from animal studies, but the really good news is that the answer appears to be not that much.
Okay.
The animals in this study and in a number of other studies looking at animal-style emotions have found that the equivalent of basically going for a walk in people and doing that, you know, most days of the week seem to be enough to really remodel these animals' brains and make them emotionally healthier, better able to deal with stress. They have found also in people that walking for 30 minutes a day lessens the risk of depression and definitely makes people's moods better.
Let's go really big picture here. I think sometimes we have a sense that we've got physical health over here and mental health over there. I'm pointing in two different directions for those on the radio. Should we stop thinking that way and really look more and more about the overlap between the two?
Yes. And that's one of the things that I really like about reporting on neuroscience is the more that scientists learn about the brain, the more obvious it is that there is no disconnection between the mind and the body, that what happens in your brain, if you make new neurons, that's obviously affecting your body, but it really directly affects your mood and how you feel. And you can't separate the two, and it does appear that exercise, more so than at least any drug yet discovered, profoundly affects both your body and your mind. It'll make you feel better, and it'll definitely make your body function better.
Now, Gretchen, I know you're a runner. I know you've slowed down, you've said, over the years, but you're a runner. Do you think you've seen this at play in your own life?
I hope that I deal better with stress, because I can't imagine how badly I deal with it when I didn't run. I know that when I really am feeling overwhelmed, if I go out and go for 20 minutes of running, even walking, I come back and I'm much better able to deal with whatever the situation is. So obviously that's not scientific, but it's nice to read these studies and see, you know, my experience definitely validated. And I think it's true for a lot of people.
Do you think this is far enough along now that a doctor can say, get some exercise for your anxiety? I mean, maybe they're not prescribing it, but I guess it can't hurt anything.
As a matter of fact, there is a pretty well-advanced movement to start prescribing, formally prescribing exercise, especially for conditions like depression. And there are studies underway to determine what the quote-unquote dose, the best dose of exercise would be, and to actually have it be a formal prescription. It appears to be, for many people, as effective as at least some drugs, and it might convince people to actually do it if they have a little prescription written out that says, put on your shoes and go walk for half an hour.
Right, that sounds like something, you know, that insurance companies could get behind, too, in different ways. And they're starting to do that. We're starting to see that. Well, Gretchen, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds is the phys ed columnist for the New York Times. She does the Well blog.
And you can join this discussion on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know. Do you go out and get some exercise when you're feeling overwhelmed, feeling anxious? Does it work? What works for you? Walking, running, out in the woods? Intense weightlifting? Let us know at the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, we're going to talk to pollster Charles Franklin about the new Marquette survey released today. And then the former director of the census will tell us why we're doing race wrong in the U.S. Census. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Stick around. There's more Central Time coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.